dead because Malcolm revived it and went around the third world to promote its acceptance and endorsement. Malcolm was a continuum of several other African-American freedom fighters, dating from Frederick Douglass, who traveled abroad during slavery to enlighten others about our plight and to enlist their support. Malcolm also had learned much from Marcus Garvey and Dr. Du Bois, who predicted that the color question would characterize the 20th century. We know that. We can see that all over. And it's still being shown during the last decade. So he wasn't way off at all. He was on the money when he predicted that. And there was also Paul Robeson, who put to service his magnificent, powerful voice to inform the world in speeches and songs, especially spirituals, of the injustices of our suffering, as well as our determination to overcome. Paul never was a pessimist. He could see a lot of positive things in our past, even though there wasn't enough in the present. He knew that the future belonged to us. And among other heroes, there was Ida B. Wells. You know, too often we quote all of the men who are the leaders. We got a lot of heroes, ladies and gentlemen, brothers, sisters, comrades, and friends. Ida Wells, who carried our message across the seas, so that all of them were role models for Malcolm. We didn't have any Messiah who, you know, developed on the scene overnight. Those who are willing to learn from history have found that they didn't invent the wheel, that there are positive things that they could carry on to an even higher level. And that's what Malcolm X did for us. Now, Ghana was a magnet for me, as well as for many other African Americans who had lived through the tumultuous era of McCarthyism and other forms of persecution. And we really needed sustenance in order to persevere. The achievement of independence by Ghana in 1957 was a beacon and an inspiration to us. Ghana's presence at the United Nations was a spark of hope. We were aware when we went there, or if you didn't know before, we learned that the Victorious Convention People's Party's program called for a new form of government, an economy, in which the ownership and the distribution of the natural resources and wealth of the country would be based on principles of scientific socialism to replace that of a colonialist rule of exploitation. We were heartened by Ghana's progress under President Kwame Nkrumah in the fields of education, health, building of its infrastructure in agriculture and industry. We were there, we had a chance to see it. And indeed, when I got there, already there were several African Americans who had gone much earlier than I did to live, work, and use their skills to help in this development. Now, I was privileged, and I say this because it was a privilege, to accompany Dr. Du Bois, whom I had known in the States for many years, both him and his wife, Shirley. Dr. Du Bois, as you know, invested a lot of his life into Africa, and was then living in Ghana. And he regularly went, was driven, because he was an old man then, to observe the progress in constructing that artificial harbor in Tema and the building of the largest hydroelectric dam in Africa, which was going to furnish power not only to Ghana, but to neighboring countries. So I had an opportunity to witness that growth in the presence of a great man. Our folks were really coming on. How proud we were to see that black star atop the famous archway in Accra. To see the birth of the Black Star shipping line. For those of us who are askance at the Statue of Liberty and all these other airlines, shipping lines, and others, to be in Africa and see this, baby, what a joy it was to go to the markets. Plentiful markets, well-stocked, run by sharp-thinking, strong, capable African women. And how we enjoyed, also, the lively cultural life. These people worked hard, but they could sing, they could dance, they could play music. We got rhythm, we use it, we express it. It comes out in our soul, in our bones, our movement. So we felt very much at home in Ghana. And we knew, too, that Nkrumah had lived, as was already mentioned, he lived, worked, and he studied among us in the United States. So we were a brother in spirit as well as in person when we went there. And now he was taking the leading role in championing Pan-Africanism. That was beautiful. We had a spokesman on a continental-wide scale, a continent in which the whole United States represents only a tiny part of that territory. Now, thanks to the support Nkrumah, who supported liberation movements on the continent, we had an opportunity to meet and develop friendships with several exiled Africans who had been welcome to live in Ghana. They didn't just have to stay there and be persecuted in their own countries, but when they did have to leave, or the need to study, or to work outside, they found not a refuge, but a home. And this gave us a chance to meet people outside of Ghana, fellow and sister Africans. And especially exhilarating was Nkrumah's wisdom in inviting Dr. Du Bois to undertake the mammoth task of creating the Encyclopedia Africana to record the true history of the continent from an Afrocentric point of view by knowledgeable scholars, and not as we had been taught, if we were taught anything in the West about what really took place over the centuries of development in Africa. And Dr. Alpheus Hunter, who was formerly a professor at Howard University and executive secretary of the Council on African Affairs, one of the few organizations that existed and really did tremendous work that a lot of people didn't know about then. One in which Dr. Du Bois, Paul Robeson, and many others were active. long before people even knew whether it was South Africa or cared anything about it. Alpheus had become Dr. Du Bois's associate because Dr. Du Bois was old and couldn't get around as much. And his assignment was to locate and to organize both the human and the other resources so that they could get this major project underway. It was said because Du Bois in Krumah, having known us in the United States, he made the maximum use of African Americans who were there. And Dr. Du Bois's wife, Shirley Graham, had been assigned the responsibility of establishing an educational television network in Ghana so as to make available to people a lot of the knowledge that they could have if they didn't have the books or the papers, or if they, you know, were just not literate enough to use this method, this media, as an educational tool. Now, when the news that Malcolm would soon be in our midst, when we that circuit brought joy and excitement to our sizable African-American community. In fact, I think more African-Americans live in Ghana than in any other part of Africa. And we had a lot of folks there, and it was really a lift when we knew, here comes Malcolm. And of course you know that Malcolm was enthusiastically welcomed by heads of state, certainly by Nkrumah, and accorded privileges that are rarely, if ever, given to a non-official foreigner. He was recognized and accepted as a contemporary shining black prince, as Austin Davis has described him, but also a warrior in the best tradition of his illustrious ancestors. Now, undoubtedly, you've read about Malcolm's activities in Ghana in his own biography, and you, I'm sure, may have even read Maya Angelou's book, Traveling Shoes, in which she speaks about it, and there have been many other articles since then. And I'm sure that my friend Alice, our next speaker, will supply additional details and insights on this subject. I was a member of Malcolm X's committee that we set up there when we found that he would be around. And so I was privileged to arrange and accompany him at meetings with the Chinese and Algerian ambassadors. I was able to do that because my job in Ghana, one of the jobs I had, because I'd gone there without anything financial-wise, was to teach conversational and colloquial English to the staffs of several embassies, and that included Cuba, China, Algeria, and interestingly enough, also Romania. And so having access to people like that, it was possible for me to speak to them. And they urged me by all means to set up meetings with Malcolm. And so that was my privilege. When we went to the Algerian embassy, of course, they speak English. I studied English way back. And I used to read it, newspapers aloud, just to keep, you know, a feeling of speech as well as reading ability alive. And somehow, with my poor French, I was able to make myself understood to the ambassador and to communicate whatever Malcolm had to say to them. I also had an opportunity to help the Cuban ambassador, who arranged a tremendous reception for Malcolm at his embassy office. Malcolm was only going to be in Ghana for a short period, and he obviously could not, attend and meet people everywhere. And so Armando, ambassador of Cuba, thought it would be a good thing for him to hold a big reception, invite everybody there, so that Malcolm wouldn't have to run around to every place they showed up. They were all people from third, quote, world countries, and that included the embassies too. It is very interesting that the only person, ambassador from Europe or the Western world, was the Albanian ambassador. I don't know how he got on the Cuban ambassador's list, but he certainly paid for it when the Soviet Union found out that they had not been invited. I don't know exactly how this worked out, but we did have one white ambassador present there. Now, I'm sure you recognize that photograph to your left that's there, the photograph of Malcolm. Maybe you didn't know that photograph was taken by Alice Wyndham at the airport as Malcolm departed Ghana. And I'm sure it's in the homes of many people and many institutions. And you'll notice that Malcolm was staring very fixedly. Alice caught him at a time when he was out staring the CIA and other intelligence agents who had come to the airport to see who would see Malcolm off. Of course, members of our committee were there. But I assure you that they must have been shocked when a contingent of limousines rolled into the airport, filled with ambassadors, foreign ambassadors in their country, who came to say farewell to Malcolm. So when he left, it wasn't just for waving goodbye. The people had really come to the airport to say goodbye to him. Now, the last time I saw Malcolm was at a hotel in Cairo, where he was meeting with a group of African leaders. Now, I was en route to China to teach English to advanced students at the Shanghai Institute of Foreign Languages. At that time, 1964, and as you know, China was not on the list of places that you should go to. And most of the teachers of English in China had come either from Canada, Great Britain, Australia, and New Zealand. So they had what we call, the King's English type of stuff. And there were, at the time I was there, no English language teachers from the United States. And so the ambassador, Wang Hua, asked me if I'd be interested in going, of course. The only thing I really heard about China was Edward Snow's book, and I'd gotten very interested in that. And I'd heard that China, you know what we used to think about China, the last country, in the world, forgotten man, in all of the old Fu Manchu movies, and all the stereotype stuff. So, and that's the one why I asked Dr. Du Bois, because he knew that I knew him well. You know, a little bit about me, I don't know what questions he'd ask. But evidently, Dr. Du Bois gave me a blank check to solve the question for the ambassador. And so I was able to get to China for that time. Now, Malcolm had tremendous respect and admiration for the Chinese Revolution. And had he lived longer, he would have welcomed the statement that Mao Zedong issued in 1968 after the assassination of Martin Luther King. This is the title. I have a little pamphlet here. In support of the African-American struggle against violent oppression. Chairman Mao was the only head of state throughout the world to respond to the appeal to him that was made by another African-American freedom fighter, whose name you might recognize, Robert Williams, the author of Negroes with Guns. When Bob left for Cuba, he was invited to China, and I spent an awful lot of time with him when I was working in Peking. It's interesting that I was in Shanghai at the time I received word that Malcolm had been assassinated. I was also in Shanghai when Nkrumah came through on his way to Hanoi to try to discuss with Ho Chi Minh some question about the Vietnam War. When he got off the airplane, he was greeted by Premier Zhou Enlai and other Chinese officials, and that's where he learned that there had been a coup. And so I happened to be in China at a time when both Nkrumah had come to a very serious political situation in his own country, when our beloved Malcolm was killed. I was also there to see Mao Zedong as the leader of the biggest non-white country taking a position in our support. And Malcolm's last words to me as I left the hotel were, and this is a paraphrase, I don't remember, that was way back in 64, but I remember the essence. He said, "I probably will never travel to China, but learn all you can about the revolution and tell them about us. But be sure to return and share your knowledge." Now, I heeded his advice, and my first major project was to have each student in my class research and write a chapter on the history of African Americans from the slavery period to 1960. Later, after they had done this, they gave an oral presentation of their findings to an audience of English-speaking Chinese teachers from several cities around China who had come there for a conference. And so, where it came from me, it extends to my students, and then to future teachers. So as you can see, Malcolm had a tremendous impact on me, and his spirit marches on.